Lincoln, Disc 6.
In the fall of 1844, Logan and Lincoln decided to dissolve their highly successful partnership. The senior partner told Lincoln that he wanted to go into business with his son, David Logan, and Lincoln didn't argue with his decision. Perhaps he wasn't satisfied to receive less than half the income from the partnership. Perhaps he realized that his political aspirations must clash with those of Logan, since both wanted to go to Congress. But there were no hard words as the partners decided, as Logan said, to go their ways amicably and in friendship. The severance was not an abrupt one. Logan and Lincoln continued to appear together in the December term of the Illinois Supreme Court, and their professional notice ran in the Sangamo Journal until March 1845. They continued to join forces on important cases throughout the remaining years of Lincoln's practice. Lincoln took a new partner. One fall morning in 1844, he came dashing up the stairs to the third floor of the Tinsley Building, where he found William H. Herndon busily studying. "Billy," he asked breathlessly, "do you want to enter into partnership with me in the law business?" Herndon managed to stammer, "Mr. Lincoln, this is something unexpected by me. It's an undeserved honor. And yet, I say, I will gladly and thankfully accept the kind and generous offer." Sensing that the young man was flustered with gratitude, Lincoln remarked easily, "Billy, I can trust you if you can trust me." And the partnership came into being. Many found the new partnership puzzling. Now an established, prominent lawyer, Lincoln could have had his pick of distinguished Illinois attorneys. Herndon heard that John Todd Stewart very much wanted to renew his association with Lincoln, and was resentful when a beginner was chosen instead. Lincoln left no record of his reasons, but it's clear that he was tired of being a junior partner and wanted to head his own firm. He was already attracting all the business he could handle, so that he didn't need a partner with a name to draw in clients. He thought Herndon had considerable promise as a lawyer. He'd watched him read law for 2 or 3 years in the office of Logan and Lincoln, and found him a laborious, studious young man, far better informed on almost all subjects than I've been. There were also political reasons behind his choice of Herndon. Lincoln aspired to go to Congress, but the Whig Party in central Illinois was split into 2 distinct factions. In the past, leadership had come from the eminently respectable Stuarts and Edwardses, few in number but rich in family tradition. But the majority of the Whig voters were now self-made men, men who had power, scorned the older leadership, and wanted a hand in shaping party policy. Lincoln needed the support of both factions. Marriage to the elegant Mary Todd gave him a connection to the silk stocking element of the party, but the shrewd wild boys about town favored the enormously popular Edward D. Baker. Recognizing that Herndon was a leader of this populist element in the party, Lincoln chose him as a partner in part to give a signal to the insurgent young Whigs that he hadn't deserted them. More important than any of these calculations was the essential fact. Lincoln really liked Herndon. He respected Stuart, and he admired Logan, but for neither of them did he have genuine affection. Toward Herndon, however, he had an almost paternal feeling, and Herndon, in turn, gave him absolute and unquestioning loyalty. During the long years of their partnership, he always addressed Herndon, 9 years his junior, as Billy, while Herndon invariably called him Mr. Lincoln. There was much to like about this new partner. He bubbled over with ideas and enthusiasm. He longed to be part of the larger intellectual world, and though he'd been born in Kentucky, he wrote that he steadily turned New England words for my ideas, my sentiments, my education. He developed an unmanageable appetite for books. A credulous law student believed that, in addition to all his professional reading, Mr. Herndon read every year more new books in history, pedagogy, medicine, theology, and general literature than all the teachers, doctors, and ministers in Springfield put together. On his shelves were authors almost unknown in the Mississippi Valley: Kant, Renan, Fichte, Buckle, Froude. Perhaps he didn't always understand what he read, but he learned enough to become a kind of frontier evangelist for transcendentalism, that Emersonian faith that the questioning heart could, without mediation of religion or authority, discern truth. He prided himself on his mud instinct, his dog sagacity, which enabled him to see to the gizzard of questions. What he saw encouraged him to believe in illimitable progress, and he greeted the unseen with a cheer. The struggles of this age and succeeding ages for God and man, religion, humanity, and liberty, may they triumph and conquer forever, is my ardent wish and most fervent soul prayer. He and Lincoln were in almost every way exact opposites. Lincoln was tall, slow-moving, and careless in dress. Herndon was short, quick, and something of a dandy, affecting patent leather shoes and kid gloves. Lincoln was melancholy, his depressed moods interrupted by outbursts of antic humor. Herndon was always upbeat and optimistic, and he had no sense of humor at all. The senior partner disliked generalities, and his mind cautiously moved in logical progression from one fact to the next, while his junior leapt ahead, using intuition to arrive at his conclusions. Once, when Herndon urged his partner to talk faster and with more energy when addressing a jury, Lincoln replied by graphically illustrating the difference between his mind and his partner's. "Give me your woman's little knife with its short twin blades, and give me that old jackknife lying over there," he told Herndon. Then he opened the short blades of the small knife and said, "See, here, it opens quickly, and at the point travels through but a small portion of space. But see this long-bladed jackknife? It opens slowly, and its points travel through a greater distance of space than your little knife. It moves slower than your little knife, but it can do more execution. Just so with these long convolutions of my brain," Lincoln added. "They have to act slowly, pass, as it were, through a greater space than shorter convolutions that snap off quickly. I'm compelled by nature to speak slowly. I commence way back, like the boys do when they want to get a good start. My weight and speed get momentum to jump far." The new partners occupied a room in the Tensley Building, and Herndon took the lead in buying desks, a table, and some basic books at a cost of $168.65, half of which was charged to his partner. It remained wretchedly bare. Gibson W. Harris, a student in the law office, described it. The furniture, somewhat dilapidated, consisted of one small desk and a table, a sofa or lounge with a raised head at one end, and a half dozen plain wooden chairs. The floor was never scrubbed. Over the desk, a few shelves had been enclosed. This was the office bookcase, holding a set of Blackstone, Kent's Commentaries, Chitty's Pleadings, and a few other books. At the outset, it wasn't an equal partnership. Lincoln interviewed most of the clients, wrote the important legal papers, and pleaded the suits in court. Herndon, still the student and the learner, performed routine jobs. He answered inquiries as to Lincoln's whereabouts, or toted books and hunted up authorities for the senior partner's use. It was also his responsibility to manage the office, preserve the records, and keep the files straight. As Lincoln later told Henry C. Whitney, a fellow lawyer in Urbana, he supposed that Herndon had system and would keep things in order. His hope was misplaced, for Herndon was not an orderly person. It's doubtful, though, that anyone could have kept Lincoln's papers in order. The firm had no filing cabinets and no files. In one corner of the office was a bundle of papers with a note in Lincoln's handwriting, "When you can't find it anywhere else, look in this." Herndon sometimes took legal papers home, where they were lost. Lincoln frequently stuck documents and correspondence in his stovepipe hat, which Herndon said was his desk and his memorandum book. As a result, the partners were constantly looking for misplaced letters and documents, and there were times when they had to confess frankly that papers sent them were lost or destroyed and cannot be found after search among the papers of Lincoln and Herndon. Lincoln's name drew clients to the new firm, and soon the partners had as much business as they could well manage. They appeared in their first case in the Sangamon County Circuit Court in March 1845, and their first suit in neighboring Menard County was called in May of the same year. During the first 12 months of partnership, the firm had 14 cases in the circuit court at Springfield. The following year, the partners handled more than twice as many. The Lincoln and Herndon fee book for 1847 listed over 100 cases in which Lincoln participated before he left in October to serve in Congress. Like most other attorneys, Lincoln and Herndon took on whatever clients came their way. They defended persons charged with murder, burglary, assault, embezzlement, and almost every other kind of crime. Sometimes their clients were innocent, and sometimes they were guilty. But the partners felt that all were entitled to be represented. Nor was Lincoln squeamish about the social implications of the cases he argued. In 1841, he appeared before the Illinois Supreme Court in the case of Bailey versus Cromwell, which concerned the attempted sale of a young black woman, Nance, in Tazewell County. The court followed his reasoning in ruling. The presumption of law was, in this state, that every person was free, without regard to color. The sale of a free person is illegal. But 6 years later, he appeared for Robert Matson, who was trying to recover his runaway slaves in Coles County. Matson had brought his Kentucky slaves across the Ohio River to work on his farm in southern Illinois. When the slaves ran away, and with the backing of local abolitionists, brought suit for their freedom, on the ground that the Northwest Ordinance forbade the introduction of slavery into the state of Illinois, Matson employed Lincoln, along with Usher F. Linder, to defend him. Characteristically, Lincoln admitted his opponent's main argument, that the slaves were free if Matson had brought them to Illinois for permanent settlement. But he invoked the right of transit, which the courts had guaranteed to slaveholders who were taking their slaves temporarily into free territory. He placed great stress on Matson's public declaration, at the time he brought the slaves into Illinois, that he didn't intend the slaves to remain permanently in Illinois, and insisted that no counterstatement had ever been made publicly or privately by him. The circuit court ruled against Lincoln and his client, who, it was reported, left immediately for Kentucky without paying his attorney's fees. Neither the Matson case nor the Cromwell case should be taken as an indication of Lincoln's views on slavery. His business was law, not morality. The partner's fees remained small. An appearance before a justice of the peace cost $5, and the usual fee for representing a client in the circuit court ranged from $10 to $25. In a very few cases of special difficulty, the firm charged $50, and on one occasion, an appearance before the Illinois Supreme Court brought $100. Lincoln believed strongly in making explicit financial arrangements before entering into a case. The matter of fees, he noted in his projected lecture to young lawyers, is important far beyond the mere question of bread and butter involved. Occasionally, he took on a case for a contingency fee. If the client was willing to risk the cost, he promised in one letter, "I'll do my best for the biggest kind of a fee if we succeed, and nothing if we fail." But for the most part, he worked for fixed and agreed-upon fees, and he advised young lawyers not to take more than a small retainer in advance, lest they lose incentive and interest. He didn't hesitate to don a client. "I'd like to have the little fee in the case, if convenient." He disliked suing for fees, but on at least six occasions he felt obliged to do so. Despite differences in age and experience, the partners divided all income equally. Lincoln imitated the generosity that Stuart had shown him, rather than the niggardliness that Logan had practiced. After the first few months, the partners kept no systematic accounts, simply dividing equally the fees they received. As Lincoln told Whitney, "Billy and I never had the scratch of a pen between us. We just divide as we go along." But Herndon did keep a record of cases in which the fees due to the partners weren't immediately collected, carefully marking them paid as the money was received. No amount of industry or care could earn a lawyer a satisfactory income from practice in Sangamon County alone. Most Springfield attorneys who weren't independently wealthy felt obliged to travel with the judge of the circuit court when he made, twice every year, his pilgrimage from one county seat to another in his district. The vast Eighth Circuit, which eventually encompassed 11,000 square miles, stretched across two-thirds of the width of the state and one-third of its length. Both Stuart and Logan regularly traveled at least part of the circuit. Even Herndon, who disliked the migratory life and preferred to remain in Springfield, estimated that he was on the circuit about one-fourth of the time. Lincoln, who'd only occasionally attended courts in neighboring counties during the first years of his practice, became one of the most regular riders of the circuit. The judge and the more affluent lawyers traveled the circuit in buggies, but Lincoln, in the early days, rode his rather decrepit horse, Old Tom, carrying a change of underclothing, any necessary legal papers, and perhaps a book or two in his capacious saddlebags. When he could afford it, he had a local blacksmith make him a nondescript buggy. The countryside through which the procession traveled was sparsely inhabited, and they could go for miles without seeing another human. The caravan could usually travel only about 4 miles an hour because the roads were atrocious. Most were little more than trails, and when the heavy black loam of the Illinois prairie began to thaw in the spring, it became fathomless mud, dangerous not merely to carriages but to horseback riders as well. Many streams had no bridges, and the judge often asked Lincoln, who had the longest legs of any member of the bar, to explore for a ford. If Lincoln could get over, the others would follow. At night, they stopped wherever they could find lodgings. Sometimes, Herndon remembered, they slept with 20 men in the same room, some on old ropes, some on quilts, some on sheets, a straw or two under them. When they arose the next morning, a pitcher of cold water outside and a single towel served for their ablutions. Those who got up late often found the towel too wet to use. After a breakfast of greasy food and what Leonard Sweat, the Bloomington lawyer who regularly traveled the Eighth Circuit, called pretty tough coffee, pretty mean, the caravan moved on toward the next county seat. Arriving on a Saturday or a Sunday, the lawyers resorted to a favorite hotel or tavern near the courthouse, where, again, they slept two or three to a bed. The next morning, the lawyers would be approached by litigants, often with their local counsel, who were glad to have the help of more experienced attorneys from Springfield and Bloomington, the two largest towns on the circuit. Business had to be transacted speedily. Declarations and traverses drafted, petitions written, lists of witnesses drawn up, so that the judge could hear cases on Monday afternoon. There was little time to study cases closely, much less to look up precedents. Lawyers on the circuit had to rely mostly on general knowledge and common sense. Clients and local counsel eagerly sought Lincoln's services. On the circuit, his reputation for integrity and fairness was even more important than in more technically difficult cases appealed to the state Supreme Court. In about a third of the cases in which Lincoln appeared on the circuit, he acted alone. In the others, he worked with local counsel. He had few criminal cases and not many cases in chancery. Herndon enumerated the kinds of cases that formed the bulk of his circuit practice: assault and battery, suits on notes, small disputes among neighbors, slander, warranties on horse trades, larceny of a small kind. Lincoln nearly always had as much business as he could readily handle, but it was never as great as that of the most prominent local attorneys. After the court adjourned each day, the lawyers had leisure to prepare new cases, or they could explore the meager resources of the little towns they visited, all of which, except Springfield, Bloomington, and Pekin, had fewer than 1,000 inhabitants. Mostly the attorneys had to amuse themselves, and, according to Herndon, they engaged in fights, foot and horse races, knockdown, wrestling, gambling, etc. Whiskey, he noted, was abundant and freely used. After supper, the judge and the lawyers might attend some local amusement, like a circus or a lecture. But if there was no other diversion, they'd sit before the fire and swap tall tales and anecdotes. When that happened, Lincoln, of course, was a center of attention. And, as Herndon remembered, judges, jurors, witnesses, lawyers, merchants, etc., etc., have laughed at these jokes till every muscle, nerve, and cell of the body in the morning was sore at the whooping and hurrahing exercise. By the end of the week, the session was ended, and the judge and the attendant lawyers moved on to the next county seat. It took at least 10 weeks to complete the circuit, and then the whole process had to be repeated in the fall. Consequently, Lincoln spent about 3 months of every year traveling the Eighth Judicial Circuit. and he sometimes made additional trips on legal business to other counties that were not on this circuit. Many of the other attorneys returned to their homes over the weekends, but Lincoln generally remained with the court. In the early years of his marriage, friends reported that he was desperately homesick and turning his head frequently towards the South. And he usually broke the long fall term with a visit to Springfield. But it made no sense for him to keep rushing home. He was on the circuit to earn money, and the longer he stayed in the small country towns, the better acquainted he became with the local lawyers who could throw cases his way. His investment of time and energy paid off. He probably earned more than $150 a week beyond expenses while he was on the circuit. Staying in these small towns also gave him a political advantage. And in his future political contests, his strongest supporters were attorneys and clients he met on the circuit. He got to know thousands of central Illinois voters by name. In 1847, when J.H. Buckingham, a reporter for the Boston Courier, made a stagecoach trip through central Illinois with Lincoln, he found that he knew or appeared to know everybody we met, the name of the tenant of every farmhouse, and the owner of every plat of ground. Such a shaking of hands, such a how-d'ye-do, such a greeting of different kinds as we saw was never seen before, the newspaperman continued. It seemed as if he had a kind word, a smile, and a bow for everybody on the road, even to the horses and the cattle and the swine. In addition, Lincoln remained on the circuit because he enjoyed the life. What others considered hardships were matters of complete indifference to him. He didn't care where he slept, and he ate whatever food was put in front of him. If there were drawbacks to life on the circuit, the hearty masculine atmosphere more than compensated for them. Traveling the circuit gave him relief from a domesticity that he sometimes found smothering. The Lincolns' domestic life was often troubled. Husband and wife were as different in temperament as they were in physique. He was slow, moody, given to bouts of melancholy and long periods of silence. He depended on his inner resources. She was lively, talkative, and sociable, constantly needing the attention and admiration of others. Indifferent to what other people thought, he wasn't troubled when visitors found him in his favorite position for reading, stretched out full length on the floor. She, who'd grown up in houses with liveried black servants, was embarrassed when he answered the doorbell in his shirt sleeves. A shortage of money contributed to their problems. Because Lincoln's income was low during the early years of their marriage, they could afford only a tiny house. Overcrowded when they moved in, it became more so after 1846 with the birth of their second son, Edward, named after Lincoln's political associate and friendly rival, Edward D. Baker. A minor remodeling of the house to create a new downstairs bedroom didn't do much to ease the situation. Yet Mary loyally never made any public complaint about their straitened circumstances, nor spoke of financial stringency in her letters. Instead, she let gossip blame her for failing to show hospitality, when her house was so small that it had no dining room and meals had to be served in the kitchen. Similarly, she gained a reputation for stinginess when, in fact, she was trying to run a household on a very limited budget. Lincoln, immersed in his own work, probably had no idea how hard his wife had to labor. She had to cook, clean, and scrub. She had to pump the water in the backyard and haul it into the house for heating. She had to keep the wood fire going in the kitchen stove and, during much of the year, in the living room fireplace. Though Lincoln had his suits made by Benjamin R. Biddle, the local tailor, she had to sew all her own clothes, as well as those of her children. Her purchases at John Irwin and Company, the Springfield General Store, included needles, buttons, thread, muslin, calico, cambric, whale bones, and corset lace. And above all, she had to pay close attention to her babies, especially to little Eddie, who was a sickly child. Despite the money her father gave her, she only occasionally had assistance in any of these chores. For a short time, Harriet Hanks, one of Lincoln's cousins, who was attending the Springfield Female Seminary, helped out in the house, but she and Mary didn't get along. More often, she had an Irish-born maid, one of the wild Irish, as she called them. But she thought they were undependable and lazy, and she quarreled with them all. Mary Lincoln's bad temper was famous in Springfield. Everybody heard stories about the tongue-lashings that she gave to maids, to workmen about the house, to street vendors, and to her husband. In part, these were the result of overwork and exhaustion on the part of a woman who, up to the time of her marriage, had never turned her hand. In part, they reflected the unsteady condition of her health. Every spring she was afflicted with excruciating headaches, possibly the result of an allergy, and she suffered much from menstrual cramps. Highly emotional, she was terrified of lightning storms, of dogs, of robbers, and when she was in a panic, she couldn't control her actions. In considerable measure, Mary Lincoln's outbursts were reactions to her husband's behavior. He was a very difficult man to live with. For 3 months out of every year, he was off riding the circuit, and she was left alone in her tiny house with two squalling children and, at best, an incompetent maid. She understood, and didn't protest, the financial needs that sent Lincoln traveling. But she sadly told a neighbor, if her husband had stayed at home as he ought to, that she could love him better. Even when he was at home, he didn't provide the comfort, the warmth, the affection that she craved. After a busy day at work, seeing clients and attending to cases in court, he wanted to sit quietly before the fire, reading, and he failed to realize that his wife, cooped up in the house all day with no one to talk to but infants, longed for adult conversation. Sometimes his inattention made her fly off the handle. On one occasion, as he sat reading in his rocking chair in the living room while she cooked dinner, she warned him that the fire was about to go out. Absorbed in his reading, he didn't respond, and she called out again, and then a third time. Furious at being ignored, she found a way of getting his attention. She struck him on the nose with a piece of firewood. Such episodes were infrequent. The subject of much gossip in Springfield, they incorrectly represented the Lincolns' marriage. For all their quarrels, they were devoted to each other. In the long years of their marriage, Abraham Lincoln was never suspected of being unfaithful to his wife. She, in turn, was immensely proud of him and was his most loyal supporter and admirer. When someone compared her husband unfavorably to Douglas, she responded stoutly, "Mr. Lincoln may not be as handsome a figure, but the people are perhaps not aware that his heart is as large as his arms are long." Their children further cemented their marriage. Both the Lincolns had to learn that parenting is a difficult art. And inevitably they made mistakes, especially with their first son. A short, chubby fellow, who, from birth, seemed to resemble the Todds more than the Lincolns, high-strung and overprotective, Mary constantly worried over Bob. And when the little boy disappeared from her sight for a few minutes, she was likely to alert the whole neighborhood that he was lost. Lincoln, for his part, gave too little attention to his oldest son. He didn't ignore the child deliberately, but nothing in his upbringing suggested that a father should be comforting and nurturing. Occasionally he took the boy for walks, and when he was chopping firewood in the backyard, he let his son help by splitting kindling. There's a touching account of Bob as a 4-year-old trying to walk in his father's gigantic boots. But Robert's principal memory of his father during these years was of his loading his saddlebags in preparation for going out on the circuit. Both parents made some attempt to discipline their firstborn, who seems to have been a perfectly normal little boy, no more given to mischief than other children his age. But the whippings Mary administered were ineffectual, the more so because her husband made fun of her efforts, and when he tried to correct the child, she gave him a tongue-lashing. After the birth of Eddie, both parents pretty well gave up disciplining their offspring. Years later, Mary reported that her husband said, "It's my pleasure that my children are free, happy, and unrestrained by parental tyranny. Love's the chain whereby to bind a child to its parents." Pride in their children helped the Lincolns through even the worst of their domestic discord. When Robert was only 3 years old, Lincoln described him to Speed in a characteristic understatement that couldn't conceal his satisfaction with his firstborn. "He's quite smart enough. I sometimes fear he's one of the little rare ripe sort that are smarter at about 5 than ever after." A few years later, Mary did her own boasting when she wrote a friend, "I have a boy studying Latin and Greek, and will be 10 years old in a few days." Politics was another bond that held the Lincoln marriage together. Mary Lincoln, like her husband, was an ardent Whig. In a sense, they inherited their politics, for Mary's father was an influential Whig spokesman in Kentucky, and Thomas Lincoln hoped for the election of a Whig president who would make locofoco, that is, democratic principles, crumble to dust. Both the Lincolns admired Henry Clay, the founder of the Whig Party. Mary, because he was a friend of the Todd family in Lexington. Her husband, because Clay was his beau ideal of a statesman. From the beginning of Lincoln's political career, he supported the Whig Party. As late as 1859, he characterized himself as always a Whig in politics. He was a strong defender of Whig economic policies against the proposals offered by the rival Democrats, and he usually stressed one principal issue in each campaign. In 1840, for instance, he repeatedly argued for a national bank, favored by most Whigs, and opposed the independent treasury system endorsed by the Democrats. During the presidential election of 1844, Lincoln, like most other northern Whigs, made the protective tariff his weapon to combat the Democrats, who favored low customs duties or free trade. On all these issues, Lincoln closely followed the National Whig Party line, which he sometimes seemed to echo rather than to understand. In the 1840 campaign, his frequently repeated address attacking the Democrats' sub-treasury plan and advocating a new national bank was a respectable, though certainly not an original, piece of work. His speeches in 1843 and 1844 on the tariff were confused and demagogic. A protective tariff, he claimed, would have no effect at all on the common man. It would be collected only from those whose pride, whose abundance of means, prompt them to spurn the manufactures of our own country and to strut in British cloaks and coats and pantaloons. On the stump, he tried to argue that a high tariff made everything the farmers bought cheaper, but, according to a hostile reporter, said also he couldn't tell the reason, but that it was so. Lincoln was apparently sufficiently dissatisfied with his own argument that he continued to examine the tariff question after the election, and he studied Herndon's copies of both Henry C. Carey's Essay on the Rate of Wages, published in 1835, and Francis Whelan's Elements of Political Economy, 1837. He learned much from Whelan's lucidly written text, but rejected its free trade doctrines. Carey's pro-tariff tract made a deeper impression. Over several months, he jotted down on 11 foolscap half-sheets his thoughts and conclusions about protection that showed that he was still wrestling to master the subject. On reflection, he now concluded that tariff duties would not bear only on the rich. They would be shared equally among the producer, the merchant, and the consumer of taxed goods. To end protective tariffs would actually increase costs, because so much would be wasted on the useless labor of carrying goods back and forth to foreign markets. Such useless labor helped to perpetuate a system where some have labored and others have, without labor, enjoyed a large proportion of the fruits. This is wrong and shouldn't continue, Lincoln concluded. To secure to each laborer the whole product of his labor, or as nearly as possible, is a most worthy object of any good government. But that reflection took him far beyond Whig orthodoxy and far beyond any possible campaign speech. He quietly filed his notes away. Membership in the Whig Party meant something more than issues to Lincoln. He thought the party was grounded on principles in which he passionately believed. To him, it embodied the promise of American life. Economically, it stood for growth, for development, for progress. Clay's American system sought to link the manufacturing of the Northeast with the grain production of the West and the cotton and tobacco crops of the South, so that the nation's economy would become one vast interdependent web. When economic interests worked together, so would political interests, and sectional rivalries would be forgotten in a powerful American nationalism. Class antagonisms would also be erased, because this just and generous and prosperous system opens the way for all, gives hope to all, and energy and progress and improvement of condition to all. This was a vision that attracted many of the wealthiest and best educated members of society to the Whig Party. But it was also one that appealed to young men who aspired to get ahead. Henry Clay, Lincoln's political idol, coined the term self-made man to describe Kentucky businessmen, but he might more accurately have applied it to Lincoln himself. In return for his loyalty to the Whig Party, Lincoln expected recognition, but the possibilities were decidedly limited. After the expiration of his fourth term in the Illinois State Legislature in 1841, he didn't seek re-election. That assemblage offered no new worlds to conquer. Statewide office was out of the question, because the Democrats had a hefty majority in Illinois. The state never voted for a Whig candidate for president, and it never elected a Whig governor or United States senator. Only in the newly created 7th Congressional District, which included Sangamon County, Springfield, and Morgan County, Jacksonville, along with several other counties in the judicial circuit that Lincoln traveled so regularly, did the Whigs consistently have a majority. This included the counties, then within the old 3rd Congressional District, that John Todd Stewart represented from 1839 to 1843. When Stewart made it clear that after 2 terms he was going to retire to his law practice, an intense rivalry arose among Central Illinois Whigs in the 7th District to become his successor. In the western part of the district, John J. Hardin of Jacksonville, a handsome, experienced Kentuckian, educated at Transylvania University, was the principal contender. In Sangamon County, Whigs were divided between Lincoln, the party workhorse, and Baker, the flamboyant orator. During 1843, Lincoln sought to build support for his nomination by taking an active role in Whig meetings and in drawing up an elaborate Address to the People of Illinois, a campaign circular from the Whig State Committee. At the same time, he began quietly wooing delegates to the district convention that would choose the congressional candidate. "If there are any Whigs in Tazewell County who would as soon I should represent them as any other person," he wrote a former colleague in the state legislature, "I'd be glad they wouldn't cast me aside until they see and hear further what turn things take. Now, if you should hear anyone say that Lincoln don't want to go to Congress," he wrote another friend, "I wish you'd tell him he's mistaken. The truth is, I'd like to go very much." He found his efforts frustrated by a whispering campaign. Citing Lincoln's marriage into the wealthy, exclusive Edwards-Stewart elite, Baker's supporters began characterizing him as the candidate of pride, wealth, and aristocratic family distinction. Lincoln was baffled. Surely everybody remembered that he was a self-made man with humble origins. He sought to refute the slur by assuring Baker's law partner, James H. Matheny, "Jim, I am now and always shall be the same Abe Lincoln that I always was." But the charge stuck. At the same time, Baker gained support because voters knew that he and his wife were devout Campbellites, while Lincoln, it was said, belonged to no church, was suspected of being a deist, and had talked about fighting a duel. Generously, Lincoln didn't blame Baker for these charges. The two men were close friends who shared adjacent offices in the Tinsley Building. The Lincolns thought so much of Baker that they named their second son for him. But the combined effect of these accusations undermined Lincoln's strength at the Sangamon County Convention, which endorsed Baker. Then it elected Lincoln, against his will, to serve as one of the delegates to the district convention, to assist in getting the nomination for Baker. Wryly, Lincoln wrote Speed that he was fixed a good deal like a fellow who's made groomsman to the man what has cut him out and is marrying his own dear gal. As it turned out, Baker as well as Lincoln lost the nomination at the Whig District Convention that met in Pekin in May 1843, for Hardin was the choice of the delegates. Though disappointed, Lincoln could point to 2 considerable gains. At his urging, the convention adopted a resolution endorsing Baker as a suitable person to be voted for by the Whigs of this district in the 1844 congressional election. Thus, the delegates, in effect, stipulated that Hardin should serve only a single term, and committed themselves to the principle of rotation in office. If maintained, this rule, which was widely followed in many states, would almost guarantee that Lincoln would succeed Baker. Equally important, the Whig delegates at Pekin endorsed the practice of holding conventions to nominate candidates. This ran counter to a strong streak of anti-partyism among Whigs, a feeling that open political organization and management weren't gentlemanly and had better be left to the wire-pulling Democrats. Many, like Hardin, preferred a less formal way of choosing the party's nominees. Let aspiring candidates, or their friends, present their names directly to the public. If they didn't secure a majority of the votes in a primary, they were entirely free to run as independents, but still Whigs, in the election. Lincoln had for some years been arguing for more system and organization in the party. Union is strength, was his maxim. A proliferation of candidates resulted only in Whig defeats at the polls. Employing a phrase that he would later put to better use, he reminded the party that he whose wisdom surpasses that of all philosophers has declared that a house divided against itself cannot stand. Unless the Whigs stood together, they'd once again see the spoils chuckingly borne off by the common enemy, the Democrats. Reluctantly, the 7th District Whigs accepted his argument. The next year, as he'd arranged, the Whigs of Central Illinois met again in convention, and this time, by prearrangement, they nominated Baker to succeed Hardin in Congress. Lincoln vigorously campaigned for his friend and for Clay, the Whig presidential candidate, making frequent speeches to expose the absurdities of locofocoism and confirm the soundness of the Whig candidate's position on protection, demonstrating, at least to the satisfaction of those already converted, that the English are now flooding this country with tracts and money to break down the present Whig tariff. Throughout the district, he addressed Clay clubs, where the party faithful met to sing songs praising gallant Harry and to hear their hero's merits extolled. He was so effective that David Davis called him the best stump speaker in the state, adding, "He shows the want of early education, but he has great powers as a speaker." Loyally, Herndon agreed, "If Baker or Lincoln is missing at our meetings, it seems that something's lost." All this activity was in behalf of both the Whig cause and Lincoln's own career. There was little chance that Clay could carry Illinois, but Baker won in the 7th District, and Lincoln was in line to succeed him. In the fall of 1845, a full year before the next congressional election, Lincoln began actively working to secure the nomination. Getting a pledge from Baker not to run for a second term, Lincoln went over to Jacksonville to talk to Hardin, who, he learned, had enjoyed his 2 years in the House of Representatives and gave the impression that he'd like to serve another term. For the next 6 months, Lincoln and Hardin tried to outmaneuver each other. Hardin's friends suggested nominating Lincoln for governor, knowing that would get him off the track of a congressional nomination, and knowing, too, that there was no chance that he or any other Whig could be elected to statewide office. In turn, Lincoln's supporters proposed Hardin for governor. To avoid the appearance of attempting to juggle Hardin out of a nomination for Congress by juggling him into one for governor, Lincoln discouraged his closest editorial friend, Simeon Francis of the Sangamo Journal, from endorsing the scheme, but let it be known that he'd have no objection if editors outside of Springfield urged it. Counting on the support of Sangamon and Menard counties, Lincoln expected that Morgan County, along with Scott County, the small adjacent county, would go for Hardin. It was necessary, then, for him to win in the northern part of the district, and he paid especial attention to Tazewell County, where he had a strong supporter in Benjamin F. James, the editor of the Tazewell Whig, to whom he wrote frequently and frankly about his political prospects. To Dr. Robert Bowell, the state senator from this area, he appealed tactfully. "My reliance for a fair shake, and I want nothing more, in your county, is chiefly on you, because of your position and standing, and because I'm acquainted with so few others." To all, he insisted that nothing must be said against Hardin, whom he described as talented, energetic, usually generous and magnanimous. He based his claim to the nomination not on any difference between his record and Hardin's, but simply on the grounds that turnabout is fair play. Lincoln's tactics were strikingly effective. In traveling the judicial circuit, he'd sought and secured the endorsement of leading men throughout the district before anyone had an idea that Hardin wanted to go back to Congress. By January, friends reported to Hardin that Lincoln had the nomination locked up. According to one of Hardin's correspondents, the general opinion was, "Hardin's a good fellow and did us and himself great credit in Congress. Lincoln is also a good fellow and has worked hard and faithfully for the party. If he desires to go to Congress, let him go this time. Turnabout is fair play." A friend in Tremont agreed, warning Hardin, "Our people think that it's Abraham's turn now." Realizing that he stood no chance of being endorsed at a regular party convention, Hardin wrote to Lincoln proposing new rules for selecting the congressional candidate. He sought to undo all Lincoln's careful early preparation by reverting to the former system of independent candidates. In addition, he wanted Lincoln to agree that each candidate should campaign only in his own county, a proposal that would work to his advantage because, as a former congressman, he was more widely known throughout the district than Lincoln. Lincoln rejected Hardin's proposals, declaring that he was entirely satisfied with the old system under which you and Baker were successfully nominated and elected to Congress. It was hard for him to keep his temper, because Hardin repeatedly charged him with distorting the history of the previous Whig nominations and of unfairly managing the convention system to procure his own selection in 1846, but he held his tongue. So far as possible, he kept his differences with Hardin out of the newspapers, warning Editor James that it'll be just all we can do to keep out of a quarrel, and I'm resolved to do my part to keep peace. It was less important to make a crushing retort to an opponent who was behaving ungenerously than it was to avoid alienating Hardin's numerous supporters. His tactics worked. Anticipating defeat, Hardin withdrew from the race and saved face by joining the army for the fight against Mexico. The Whig District Convention, which met on May 1st at Petersburg, fell entirely under Lincoln's control. Herndon became the permanent secretary of the convention. Lincoln's previous law partner, Logan, was chairman of the Committee on Resolutions, which celebrated Lincoln's firm support of Whig principles and his abilities and integrity. Lincoln's Democratic opponent was Peter Cartwright, the celebrated Methodist circuit rider, Famed alike for his muscular Christianity and for his devotion to Jacksonian principles. Though Cartwright was personally popular, he wasn't an effective political campaigner, and his contest with Lincoln stirred little enthusiasm among voters. Indeed, there was so little interest in the campaign that newspapers only occasionally reported public appearances by either candidate and gave no extended accounts of their speeches. Toward the end of the campaign, growing desperate, Cartwright, in the words of one Whig, sneaked through this part of the district after Lincoln and grossly misrepresented him by asserting that he was an infidel. Troubled that this accusation, which was similar to charges that had been raised in previous elections, might succeed in deceiving some honest men, especially in the northern counties of the district where he was less well known, Lincoln published a little handbill answering Cartwright's charges, admitting that in the past he'd argued for the doctrine of necessity. He noted this was a position held by several of the Christian denominations. It was true that he was not a member of any Christian church, but he denied ever having spoken with intentional disrespect of religion in general or of any denomination of Christians in particular, and declared that he could never support a man for office whom I knew to be an open enemy of and scoffer at religion. Cartwright's charge obviously had little effect. On August 3rd, the voters of the 7th District elected Lincoln by an unprecedented majority. After his election victory, Lincoln could relax. Since the 30th Congress, to which he'd been chosen, didn't assemble until December 1847, he had over a year to prepare for his move to Washington. His only notable public appearance during the intervening months was as a delegate to the gigantic River and Harbor Convention, which met in Chicago in July to protest President James K. Polk's veto of a bill that would have provided federal funding for internal improvements. As the sole Whig congressman-elect from Illinois, Lincoln attracted some attention, and his name first appeared in a nationally circulated newspaper when Horace Greeley in the New York Tribune mentioned that this tall specimen of an Illinoisan spoke briefly and happily to the convention. But for the most part, Lincoln spent his time contentedly attending to his family and cultivating his law practice. A daguerreotype made about this time, his first photographic likeness, showed a young congressman well satisfied with himself. In his best suit, he sat stiffly for the photographer, obviously proud of his tailor-made clothing. His carefully buttoned satin waistcoat, his stiff, starched shirt with gold studs, his intricately knotted black tie. Because of photographic distortion, his hands appeared even more enormous than they actually were. But it wasn't the daguerreotypist's fault that his chest looked thin and his head too small for such a tall body. He wasn't a pretty man by any means, nor was he an ugly one, wrote Herndon, who left the most vivid description of his partner's appearance. He was a homely-looking man. At this time, Lincoln weighed about 160 pounds, and he was so thin that he appeared even taller than his 6'4". His height, as Herndon pointed out, was due to the abnormal length of his legs. In sitting down on common chairs, Herndon observed, he was no taller than ordinary men from the chair to the crown of his head. A marble placed on his knee, thus sitting, would roll hipward down an inclined plane. It was only when he stood up that he loomed above other men. Mr. Lincoln's head, Herndon noted minutely, was long and tall. The size of his hat, measured at the hatter's block, was 7 1/8, his head being from ear to ear 6 1/2 inches, and from the front to the back of brain 8 inches. Thus measured, it wasn't below the medium size. Mr. Lincoln's forehead was narrow but high, Herndon continued. His hair was dark, almost black, and lay floating where the fingers or the winds left it, piled up at random. His cheekbones were high, sharp, and prominent. His eyebrows heavy and jutting out. Mr. Lincoln's jaws were long, upcurved, and heavy. His nose was large, long, and blunt, having the tip glowing in red and a little awry toward the right eye. His chin was long, sharp, and upcurved. His eyebrows cropped out like a huge rock on the brow of a hill. His face was long, sallow, cadaverous, shrunk, shriveled, wrinkled, and dry, having here and there a hair on the surface. His cheeks were leathery and flabby, falling in loose folds at places, looking sorrowful and sad. Mr. Lincoln's ears were extremely large and ran out almost at right angles from his head, caused by heavy hats and partly by nature. For all Herndon's detail, he failed quite to capture the feeling conveyed by that 1846 daguerreotype. Because a sitter had to pose for several seconds without moving, it showed Lincoln's face as grave and unsmiling. But it managed to convey a sense of a man who'd attained his goals. No longer was he attempting to impose the rule of reason upon impassioned emotions. No longer was he afflicted by swings of mood that went from Napoleonic ambition to deep melancholy. He was at peace with himself. He now felt able to come to terms with the painful memories of his early years. During the 1844 presidential campaign, he'd accepted an invitation to speak to the Whigs of Rockport in southern Indiana, an invitation that suggested his growing recognition as a leader of his party in the West. And for the first time in 15 years, he returned to the area where he'd spent his youth. He was making his usual speech, advocating the protective tariff, a subject which, a partisan paper ungrammatically declared, he handled in a manner that done honor to himself and the Whig cause, when he spotted his old schoolmate, Nathaniel Grigsby, and, interrupting himself, called out, "There's Nat!" Walking out into the audience, he greeted his old chum most cordially and insisted that he must stay overnight. After he finished his address, the two men returned to the house where Lincoln was staying and, as Grigsby remembered, they spent most of the night telling stories and talking over old times. The next day they went on to Gentryville, where Lincoln saw friends he'd grown up with and revisited the neighborhood in which I was raised, where my mother and only sister were buried. That visit broke an emotional barrier that for years had kept him from mentioning the death of his mother or the loss of his sister. He could now complete the unfinished process of grieving over his mother, a process interrupted by the suddenness of her death, her hasty burial, the absence of religious service at her grave, and his father's prompt remarriage. His emotions welled up, and over the next several months he sought to master them by expressing them in verse. "That part of the country is, within itself, as unpoetical as any spot of the earth," he wrote a friend to whom he sent what he wrote. "But still, seeing it, and its objects and inhabitants, aroused feelings in me which were certainly poetry." Lincoln expressed those feelings in four-line rhyming stanzas, which he planned to arrange into four little divisions or cantos. The first recaptured a bittersweet mixture of sorrow and joy produced by the visit. It began, "My childhood's home I see again, and sadden with the view. And still, as memory crowds my brain, there's pleasure in it too." His verses mixed backwoods slang with archaic words from his favorite British poets, and he was quite correct in doubting whether my expression of those feelings is poetry. But he accurately conveyed a fugue-like sense of almost forgotten memories. Where things decayed and loved ones lost, in dreamy shadows rise. No longer were the hardships and sorrows of his youth important. Now, freed from all that's earthly vile, his early memories were like scenes in some enchanted isle, all bathed in liquid light. With his childhood experiences unlocked, Lincoln could explore another of his deepest concerns, the overthrow of reason. In his Lyceum address, he'd urged the reign of reason to protect society against both mob violence and dictatorial ambition. And no doubt his deep, debilitating bouts of depression caused him also to realize the importance of reason as an internal gyroscope. His own fear of madness was too painful to explore. But he was able to deal with the case of Matthew Gentry, a schoolmate, whom he encountered again at Gentryville. 3 years older than Lincoln, Gentry had been rather a bright lad and the son of the rich man of our very poor neighborhood. "At the age of 19, Lincoln recalled, he unaccountably became furiously mad, from which condition he gradually settled down into harmless insanity. After seeing his childhood friend in this sad plight, Lincoln felt impelled to describe in verse the condition of a human form with reason fled while wretched life remains. The meter was lame, but Lincoln's lines managed to recapture the genuine terror he'd felt at the acts of this howling crazy man who maimed himself, fought with his father, and sought to kill his mother. He couldn't erase from his memory the madman's maniac laughter and his mournful night screams. They seemed to him the funeral dirge of reason dead and gone. O death, Lincoln's poem concluded, in an apostrophe that linked the now harmless madman to the shadowy ghosts of Nancy and Sarah Lincoln. Why dost thou tear more blessed ones hence and leave him lingering here? With that, Lincoln had exhausted his poetical inspiration. A third canto, containing a spirited description of a frontier bear hunt, was entirely different in tone. And at this point, his muse deserted him, so that he never completed a proposed fourth section. He was proud enough of his effort to send a copy of his verses to a friend in Quincy, authorizing him to print them anonymously in the Quincy Whig. "Let names be suppressed by all means," he explained. "I haven't sufficient hope of the verses attracting any favorable notice to tempt me to risk being ridiculed for having written them." At home with himself, at peace with his past, Lincoln completed arrangements to depart for Washington. He leased his house in Springfield to Cornelius Ludlam, a brick contractor, for $90 a year, carefully reserving one of the upstairs loft rooms for storing his furniture. With Herndon, he agreed that the law firm of Lincoln and Herndon should continue while he was in Congress, with the expectation that the senior partner would resume his active practice after his term was over. On October 25th, the Lincoln family left for Washington.
This ends Disc 6.